Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 69 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name's Scroobius Pip, and this week's guest is Kurt Sutter, and we had such a good long chat that it turned into a two-parter. So, yeah, that's fantastic. So, as ever, the first part, which you're listening to now, will have gone up at midnight, and we'll put part two up at midday. So check that out and enjoy it. Before we get into it, I should mention Speech Development Records. Well, that's my label. And by going to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and buying stuff, you're supporting the label and supporting the podcast. Obviously, we've got the secret podcast merch, which you'll hear about in a minute in the placed advert after the intro. But yeah, you can buy loads of stuff there for Christmas. We've got new jumpers. We've got new bobble hats. We've got all sorts of great stuff. I won't go on too much. speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Thank you very much for tuning in. Last week's guest was Chris Jericho, and that obviously went absolutely mental because he's a legend of wrestling. So it was great to chat to Chris. It was great to get the response from all you guys. As I gave the tour dates there, he's on tour. So this is, his tour started today or tomorrow. So check him out all over the UK. All the podcast dates are on there. But this week's guest was Kurt Sutter, the writer of The Shield, Sons of Anarchy, Southpaw, and The Bastard Executioner, which is my acting debut on TV. So it was exciting to talk to him, and we got so into it. He's such an interesting guy. So we had to split it into two parts. So this first half, we get into a lot of his... we talk a bit about The Bastard Executioner. A tiny bit about Sons, but then we more get into his upbringing, growing up in New Jersey, then when he moved to LA, how he got into writing, how he got into theatre and drama and all this kind of thing. We talk about his addiction. We talk about a lot of really interesting stuff. And we were so getting into all of that that we'd done like an hour practically before we'd really got to talking about Sons of Anarchy and everything else. So, yeah, that's what this half is. And then in the next half, in fact, I'll tell you about the next half at the end of this half. See you in a bit. Enjoy. This is Kurt Sutter on the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
These are good mics, man.
They're not bad, are they?
Yeah, yeah.
This is my whole setup. I've got my big heavy mic stands, which everyone mocks me for, because it's far more than you actually need for this. But I like to be kitted up.
That's good. Who I did? Oh, I know. You know Jay Moore?
Yeah.
I did his podcast.
All right, yeah, yeah.
And he's kind of the same thing.
It's good to have a good pro setup.
Yeah. It just comes with a little kit and went to my house. Like, oh, all right. That's easy.
I set up quite quick. I mean, as you saw, I've started recording now. Right. But as you saw, I was setting up as we were having conversation. Right, it was all unnoticed. Yeah. I'm a pro at this now.
You're good, man.
I'm joined by Mr. Kurt Sutter. How you doing, man?
I'm good, brother. How are you?
I'm good. We've just come off the back of The Bastard Executioner. Yeah. And I don't want to jump straight to that, but I do need to ask how you are. Because that was intense, man. That was an intense... You're in it in heavy prosthetics. Yeah. You're writing. You're just so involved in everything. So how are you feeling now it's wrapped and you can breathe?
I'm good. I have to do a couple. I'm still doing some post on the last episode I have some sound mixes to do, but otherwise it's the lion's share is all done. I'm good. I came onto this project while I was still finishing Sons.
Yeah.
So it's hard to gauge how this individually has impacted me in terms of, damage, because I started the writer's room on Bastard about 3 months before Sons ended, and not more exploratory and breaking story and research, not so much intensive, day to day. So there really wasn't a break between shows. And then this was a challenge for me physically, just because I don't like to leave my house. So never mind leave the country.
Yeah, for extended periods.
And jumping back and forth. And, we're in London now. I made you know, 3-4 trips out here just to scouts and meeting people and hiring people. And then once I brought Paris Barkley on board, you know, then I felt a little more comfortable and like things were going to be under control. And then they signed off on it and they liked the script and we went forward. But I'm good. I really it's been an incredibly satisfying experience for me in that it was a risk in terms of – it was a risk for everybody, quite frankly. Network FX really hadn't ever done a period show like this, and I certainly had never written a show like this.
I mean, it's a huge difference – From Sons, I mean, in every way, from that being in LA in modern times, in, you know, all, you know, so familiar, I guess, in that manner, and to the audience, so familiar. So, the kind of your next project from that being in West Wales and South Wales and medieval,
definitely tense. Was, you know, I'm, you know, we write what we know, and I tend, you know, my lion's share of my career has all been urban, you know, and fairly dark and mostly the crime genre, and I love that, you know, I love you know, but spending 7 years on The Shield and then coming into Sons, I just couldn't jump into another crime genre. Like, I couldn't do not necessarily, not that I was looking for a period piece, but I knew I didn't want to do yet another cop or criminal or outlaw.
I mean, you could legit get away with a lot of crime. Because of everything you'd written about and learned on that. If you wanted to go and do some crime, you could. But to write more on crime at that point, I'd imagine it's a hell of a push. If you've done, as said, that long on The Shield and then straight into Sons, you're going to run out of stories and wrangles with the law, I guess.
And I felt like, not that I was worried about things getting derivative, but I was just, quite honestly, I just needed a palate cleanse, you know, and then this project happened with Brian Grazer, and it evolved for me the way all the best work I've done evolved, which is I never planned on doing it.
Yeah.
Like, I never really planned on doing Sons until I met with John Linson, who had, you know, this notion of doing an outlaw, a family drama in the outlaw biker community. And I was always fascinated with the subculture I ride. And suddenly I was like, oh, that's cool. And from that was able to sort of create this big mythology, which as a writer I love to do. And that evolved into Sons. And Bastard happened the same way. I had no intention of writing a medieval drama, you know, or had, you know, a yearning to write about an executioner, but I met with Brian Grazer, who I adore and had so much respect for, and he was fascinated by this idea of an executioner, we started talking about that character, and I was, again, like with Sons, I was given carte blanche. It wasn't like, here's the character, here's the story. It was like, here's the idea, go.
Go and do something.
It's what I, you know, it's the blessing and the curse of, I'm giving you nothing, but with that comes no rules, no boundaries.
Yeah.
And that's what I love. So from that, the idea for Bastard Executioner came in. So it felt very organic, and that's why I didn't mind jumping right into it, because it felt like, oh, that's the way I like to work.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really plan a whole lot. Things sort of happen.
The excitement, when we first met earlier in the year and you were telling me about it, a lot of the excitement seemed to be the fact that there was so much history that you could now draw from and delve into and just lose yourself in this amazing histories of uprisings and revolutions and backstabbings and double crosses and everything there, that, again, that must have been so exciting when you'd done one particular genre and style, you'd gone into it so much, you'd really almost run that well dry from what you could even research anymore. Yeah. So to have that suddenly, here's hundreds of years of stories and tales to draw from.
It's so true. And I remember we were talking. I think I had, I'm a history guy and I love history. I love mythology. It's what I like to write. And I cut all my Western Civ classes in college. And so, when I had the opportunity to actually learn it, I was like, fuck this.
Yeah.
But
it's always the way though, man. When it's something that you're doing off your own back, there's so much more fun. If you're being told to learn this, you're like, fuck you, I ain't learning this.
Yeah,
learn something else.
But I became fascinated by the Plantagenets and that whole era of English rulers who were not of English descent and how desperately they were trying to hold on to the reign of England. And you read that mythology, and if you ever pitched some of those stories to anybody, they would say, that's too crazy, that's wild.
Yeah.
No one ever believe it. I'm like, well, it happened.
Completely. I mean, not to get political now, but it's so relevant at the moment with all the stuff that's going on with immigration. So many people don't realize how little English is in the history of England. If you know what I mean, we are a country that was always a through path, a route for so many cultures and religions and all sorts, that we've always been a big mixed breed of many different things. It's never been British people in Britain. It's like, as you said, the rulers were coming from France, from Germany, from, you know, all these different areas.
Well, you know, it's like when a chapter in your history begins and ends with conquest.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
In fact, when we were on the show, I was giving somebody shit because they were one of the actors who's a Brit was coming down on the Welsh guy because of his dialect, and I had to point out to him that actually Welsh is the original, you know, Anglis language of the country. Everybody spoke. That is the original dialect of and language of England. It's then when the Normans and the came in, that's when they shunned that and became the English language. English.
It's one of the reasons that Welsh is so protected by the Welsh. I had a guy, Hugh Stevens, on, who's a DJ over here, and he's got a record label that they release only Welsh language stuff. Yep. And there's Welsh language festivals and things like that. Growing up, I didn't know. I was like, "What? Calm down. What's the?" You know, I didn't know why it was being so. And then you realise, like, no, this is English history. This is history of the whole country rather than just of this small section.
Yeah, it really is. It's the there's the Welsh language and I forget there's another not dialect, an actual other language that is similar, but they were the original languages of what we understand to be England.
Yeah.
And which is also why it was shunned and shut down, because it was seen as dangerous.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, and I know somewhat of the rise of all that in Wales. The Welsh government and the creative board was so fucking embracing there. It was so wonderful to work with. But it really was about not just preserving Wales. It was really a sense of, no, you don't understand. This is the history of England.
Yeah.
You know, we're preserving something here that's part of England, not just part of our little rock over here.
And anything like that with a language, as you kind of touched upon there, it would have been actively shut down at the time, because that's the language that the rebellion essentially were talking, or your enemy were talking. So you don't want people talking in that language, because number one, it shows the past, and number two, they could be planning shit.
They could
be up to anything. I don't understand what they're saying. Only speak English. And that's why a language can be killed so much in times like that, times of conquest and times of rule.
That's super interesting, because I think people don't know, if anywhere you go in Wales, any public business road sign built, everything is in both Welsh and English, mm-hmm. you know, and it's...
Everyone learns a RAF, yeah. as slow as this, just because yeah. it's on every road, yeah, you just,
it's,
you know.
It's there, and but the interesting thing about that is, and I think it speaks to, not to get philosophical, but I think it really, like, that notion just bleeds into every culture and every generation, which is why, like, in, you know, in the States, it's, there's such a, you know, when you're out with someone and someone starts either, well, not so much in Los Angeles anymore, because we are mostly, you know, we're, the actual, Latino demographic is higher now than yeah. than the white and the black yeah, yeah. demographic. But there's that sense of, you know, people get uptight when people are speaking another language.
Yeah.
And I think it's, all that fear of, what are you saying?
Yeah,
you know, what are you talking about? And so it's not even,
understanding. Yeah.
yeah, it's not even so much an inconvenience as I think it strikes some primal chord, which is like, you know, what's, you know, there's something afoot. You know,
yeah.
what are they? What
there's
are
something going on in my yeah. surroundings that I can't observe. Yeah. I can't take in. I can't yeah. understand. That's scary.
Yeah,
I guess,
it's all fear based. You know? It's very interesting. Yeah, yeah, but yeah. that is definitely, you know, and I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I took a little sojourn to Venice for about eight yeah. days and to decompress and
Venice, not Venice Beach.
Again,
I was confused yeah. in one of the conversations. Yeah. I think Stephen right. and Katie were having on set, and they were talking about Venice. I was like, yeah, it's lovely. Then I was like, not that Venice,
yeah,
the Venice in LA. Right, okay, cool.
Yeah,
I get you.
No, the you know, one does not decompress in Venice Beach.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, but no, in Venice, and we were talking about you know, Cole, and I don't know Italian, and you don't really need to, but
yeah.
But we were talking about Barcelona, and I said, you know, and I believe this is true. I don't think this is just myth, but that the lisp in Barcelona was because there was a king who had a lisp, and he literally, and I'm sure I'm bastardizing history, so forgive me, Spanish people, but there was a young king who had a with her cleft palate or something, but he had a really bad lisp, and so that the Barcelona, he literally changed the phonetics of the language.
That's
so
amazing.
That everybody, so that he, you know, he spoke the true language,
yeah.
and that it just, you know, and then it just over the years became the dialect of Barcelona.
That's insane.
And to have that kind of power, but to also that sense of, you know, I don't want to be the odd man. I don't want to be speaking differently.
Yeah.
You know, so just
make everyone that way.
You look at the things that have impacted language and what changes. And, you know, it's the thing I love about Europe that you just don't get in the States is that, you know, whether it's London or Paris, especially, you walk down a street in Paris and you can just, you know, by just the architecture, you can go, okay, that's when that invasion happened. That's,
yeah.
oh, that's that influence. You know, it's like, and it's so fucking
just such huge history,
such amazing history. And that is impacted, you know, culturally, artistically, politically, and
yeah.
absolutely through language,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
you know, like I love the idea and you know, in the States we have obviously dialects, you have, you know, East Coast dialects and Southern
yeah.
dialects, but out here, the dialects from neighborhood to neighborhood, as far as Cockney and, Newcastle where
yeah.
Charlie Hunnam was from and,
yeah.
and that they're so distinctly different and
over such a small space, and again,
such a small space.
It's so hard for English people to comprehend that. And it wasn't until I toured America and realized that when I was touring the UK, I'm moaning because we had a 3-hour drive or a 4-hour drive that day in America. It's like, no, you've got a 12-hour drive today because that's how big.
Yeah.
So the spaces are that much more. So to us, driving all the way to Newcastle, that's
right.
so far away.
Right.
That's a tiny distance. And then you get the variation, you get the Midlands accents
yeah,
along
yeah.
the way. And
the combinations.
Yeah.
Of, yeah, it's really wild. And not just, I mean, I guess there's different rhythms, I guess, in American dialects too, but thing I love about here is that it's not just different vernacular in terms of words, which is part of the deal. Obviously, it's pronunciations or dropping or final consonants, or but also it's just got completely different rhythms and different speeds, the accents are on, you know, on words and parts of phrases that just don't make sense, you know, and
it makes it that bit more fascinating. Cause like there was, I took a guy called Gister on a couple of shows with us. He's a rapper from Middlesbrough, which is just near Newcastle.
Right.
And the first time I heard his stuff, the thing that excited me was I'd never heard that accent rapping.
Oh, wow.
And the flows and the syllables and sounds. It's fantastic. Wow. And it was like, I'd never heard anyone able to rap like that, because that's not how I say that word.
Right.
I can't use that particular rhythm because I don't say that word in that way. And it was just those slight changes. I was like, this is amazing. This is exciting.
Where are you from? You're from...
I'm from Essex.
Essex.
So, or my family from South London. So I've got a mixture of South London, East London kind of. And Essex is generally a bit East London. And that kind of way, accent-wise.
Because your dialect is sharp. It's distinguishable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's been, you know, like we all, like I had a heavy Jersey accent when I first came to LA.
Yeah.
And I had to get rid of that, some of that obviously for acting. But I go home and my sisters are still back in New Jersey and I hear it. And if I'm there for, you know, over a week or two, I'll come back and my kids will notice it.
Yeah.
Just certain words in pronouncing.
I've told this before, but I kind of had the opposite. I lived in the Midlands for a year. I was studying photography and film.
So Midlands?
It's kind of in the middle. So Birmingham and Wolverhampton.
Right.
So about halfway between here and Newcastle,
I guess. That's about 2 hours out?
Two and a half hours.
Right.
And I lived there for a year studying photography and film studies, and my accent got stronger there, and it felt like it was a defense mechanism. Like I came back home,
oh, I see.
And people were like, "You're not that Cockney, or not that," because I'd be, I don't know, but I guess the two or three other people I met up there that were from down south were quite proper South London, kind of more geezery. And again, I came back home, and my mates were like, That's not how you talk. And I was like, only slight changes.
Oh, that's interesting. So you gravitated towards that to distinguish you.
Yeah,
oh, that's interesting.
I guess so. Yeah. So let's talk about growing up in New York. You grew up in New York. Is that where you studied as well? And
I grew up in New Jersey, which about 40 minutes outside the city.
Yeah.
You know, suburbia. It was part of that post World War II culture where. You know, towns were sort of springing up within major cities.
Yeah.
You know, we had, I always, my, you know, badass fall too is that I grew up in the shadow of Rahway Prison.
Oh, wow.
Which is true.
Yeah.
I grew up in a town called Clark, but I grew up in the border between Clark and Rahway and, Rahway State Prison, which now is New Jersey Correctional, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's where they did Scared Straight. But I, you know, it was 5 minutes from my house and it was, you know, suburbia and it was a fine place to grow up. But very, very, homogenous. A lot of people that are born there don't leave there.
Yeah.
And again,
it's a big criticism that the Brits and Europeans tend to have of Americans is some stats somewhere of how many haven't got a passport. And again, that can be a problem when you're staying in the same place. But also, I feel America is so vast and varied that you can travel a lot and not leave the country.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So people just saying, oh, these Americans have never left the country. It's like, well, how often have people from England been to Greece and, you know, traveled around that much? But you do get that as well, just staying in that same town.
But I think that's interesting because the thing I love about being out here is, you know, again, being able, you know, I took a train to Venice, to be able to hop on a train and go, you know, you can be much more international out here just because of the exposure of it. And also, I think it's a cultural thing that I find people out here are, because they are on the same landmass, there's so much more cross culture going on, and there's no sense of weird isolationism. Don't forget, I'm in America was you know, for the longest time was all about being an isolationist, yeah. like being its own superpower, yeah. being its own entity. Completely. And I think that's sort of bred into the
USA
culture.
Number one.
Yeah. It's sort of like we don't need anybody else. Yeah. And I think it's why, you know, there's that sense of maybe it's nationalism, maybe it's pride, but I also think it's just fucking ignorance and fear, to yeah. be honest with you.
John Oliver, on his air show recently, summed it up perfectly of saying that Britain is the America of Europe. And we've always had that kind of, we're Britain. As soon as we started to tour a mainland Europe, you do exactly as you said there. I remember one day where we were in three countries, yeah. like within a few hours of each other, because we were having to get from one to the other, and this point was just through from Belgium through Germany or whatever. Yeah. And it was like, this is amazing. Yeah. At points we didn't even get any check. Do you know what I mean? We just drove along a road and suddenly like, all right, I'm in France now. Yeah. I guess this, signs are French now. That's cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
That's amazing.
It was cool for me taking the train. It's one of the reasons why I actually took the Orient Express, because I always wanted to be on a train with a sleeper car.
Yeah.
And, you know. And,
it's legendary.
I've done it once and now I'm quite okay. they are very small.
They're kind of, it's shooting a coffin along some metal tracks at great speed.
Yeah,
it's kind of, it's a disturbing thought when you actually take away the beauty and mystique of the Orient Express.
Right. But the thing that was fantastic about it was I would just go and grab a coffee and sit in one of the bar cars. And that's what I loved about it is that, you know, you take a train to the tunnel, and then you take the tunnel. They literally, it freaked me out. Because I'm a little claustrophobic. They put you in you take the English Pullman, a lovely train, old train to the border, and then they could put you in like a bus, you know, and then the bus, and I'd never been on the channel. I never knew what to expect. And we get in the bus and we ride in the thing. And I was like, well, you know, when do we get off the bus? And no, we stay in the bus just put you in the car and then they close it in. Yeah. You're like, okay,
you drive the bus into the train then the train goes into the tunnel.
The tunnel. And I'm like, okay, so I'm in a confined space that's in another confined space that's driving through a confined space.
Yeah.
So I'm
that's
just sort of like,
combination.
I'm just like, okay, don't snap and kill the old people from Illinois that are sitting next to me.
Yeah.
So, but then they put you on the Orient Express, and but the thing I loved about it is that, you know, and I didn't sleep much because there's like fucking bunk beds but you drive through and you know you go through France and you go through the countryside and you go through Belgium and you go through the Swiss Alps, and mm-hmm. it was sort of like, you know, and I took some pictures, but I was really like, I didn't want to be the dude on my iPhone.
Yeah.
Just taking,
yeah,
I was like, I was just sort of like, just fucking take it in.
Yeah.
You don't need to, you know.
I'm a big believer of that. I got to the point where when I travel a lot, I try and take some notes, but not take too many pictures. Because the fact is, on Google, there's going to be a brilliant picture of that place, but you're there now.
Right.
Exactly. So it was more important to just experience it. And I said, you know, it's just for memory, go, oh, this is what this church was or whatever else. But
that's great.
You're not going to
really
get a better picture than the amazingly shot picture.
Right.
And it feels at points that we go places, and even more so with Facebook and checking in and where else, we go places so that we can tell other people that we've been there rather than going there and experiencing it yourself.
Right,
and that's what I think the overtaking of photos becomes, of going, look, I was here.
Right.
It's like, you could, like, I would have believed you if you told me. You didn't have to get a photo out to prove that you were there. Look, I was definitely, this is where I was. But
And what was going on around you when you were there? I was taking a picture. So I took a couple to send an 8-year-old back in LA. So I wanted to sort of let her know where I was and why I wasn't at home.
Yeah.
But that was so amazing to me, like being able to go, oh, I've never been through Switzerland, you know, and then coming into Italy and then, you know, taking the the thing I loved about Venice was it was just walking, you know, yeah. and water taxis. And it was
yeah.
it was amazing to be on an island and not see a fucking car or even yeah. a motorcycle because the stairs, you can't really yeah. drive, yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah, so yeah. just to be someplace without that external stimuli.
Yeah.
Because I would be walking in. And it almost took me a minute to realize it, that I was walking and I was like, why am I so chill? Like, yeah. why, you know, and I was constantly lost because I have no navigational skills whatsoever.
I mean, you know, being lost when you've got time to be lost is an underrated yeah, thing. No, it can be a great thing. I think, again, with Google Maps and whatever else now, there's yeah, such an urgency to right. know everything. It's like, if you've got the time, there's right. nothing wrong with being lost at all.
Well, the great thing about Venice is because they're alleys, they're not really streets.
Yeah.
Google Maps, and nothing, it's useless. It doesn't know where the fuck you are. Yeah. So it's sort of like, oh. But it was so great.
I love that Google Maps is like, I don't even know.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you're on your own, dude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just enjoy yourself.
You're on that. There's a blue dot, you're there somewhere. Because the great thing about Venice is, and my wife sent me this little passage about, she was looking at Venice a few years ago. She took the kids to Florence, and basically it says that you will get lost. You will eventually retrace your steps and figure out where you yeah. are. And that's exactly what happened. Yeah. You're like, oh, because I have no sense of direction, but I have a really good memory in terms of landmarks. Because it's the only way I can survive.
Yeah.
And by like the third or fourth day, I kind of knew, like I stayed away from the tourist areas. I went to the university area because that's where most of the locals were. Yeah. That's where the cool shops were. And I would just take a water taxi there every day and pretty much kill, you know, 10 or 12 hours just sort of walking around. I did a lot of writing when I was there. And just, you know, ate unbelievable food. But, we were off on a tangent.
That's perfect. That's perfect. So you found that, you know, relaxing, inspiring to get writing done. You had the opposite in New Jersey. You know, you didn't have that. You had where you lived was very self-contained.
Yeah.
But I'd imagine, again, being in the shadow of a prison and being everything else, what kind of led you towards a writing? You studied journalism.
I did.
What was it always an urge to go towards some kind of writing or some form of outlet, or was that just what was available?
I think so. I think that, you know, it was a lovely place to grow up, and it was, and I had great parents, and you know, they did everything they could do, but even at an early age, I was sort of. I was a really obese kid. I was morbidly obese for most of my younger life, and as a result of that, I tend to isolate and be on my own. And I think because of that, there was always like my imagination. You know, when you're either, and I wasn't an only child, but I was the youngest, and my sisters are 4 and 6 years older than me, and so there wasn't really a lot of sibling interaction, so I was sort of always kind of on my own in my head and a kind of a big dreamer. So it's not like I had at a young age a sense of, oh, I want to be creative. But I just, you know, had this sort of big imagination. And I think I always had a sense of needing to be someplace else. Yeah. And you know, some of that is not a good thing. Some of that is just not being able to be in your own skin.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I grew up there. I had, you know, 12 years of Catholic schooling, and I joke that Bastard Executioner is my how I'm working out my 55 years of Catholic angst. And, and to a certain extent I am, much to the chagrin of some critics, I went to undergraduate at Rutgers, which is a state school in New Jersey, and, studied, I'd started acting in high school. Like, that was my first time I ever sort of ventured into any kind of social dynamic.
Yeah.
And I really loved it. It's like it was always about finding something, and it didn't have to be a career choice,
yeah,
but finding something that you that gives you esteem, whether it's academics, whether it's sports, whether it's music, whatever it is, you need to find something that you can own and be passionate about. And regardless of wherever it takes you, right? And
It feels good to be good at something, but also to be getting better at something.
Yes, yes.
So not just, I can walk into this and it's great. That feeling of, right, I can do this, but I can also work harder. And there's a path here of some way. Even if it's a short term, I can get that role in the school play, or I can get this next year or whatever else.
And I just find if kids don't have that, it's when they tend to get lost.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, as human beings, we need something, whether it's family, you know, for whatever that reason, you need the thing that makes you feel part of and that you're contributing. And so for me, it started like in it wasn't until like almost junior year in high school that that's cool. And, but I never had a sense of making it a career because I didn't, you know, not that my parents discouraged it. They were post-war generation. It was about fucking survival. It was about go out, get a job, settle down. You know, it was...
And I mean, it's understandably and incorrectly, in my opinion, seen as an almost unimaginable thing.
Exactly.
And the thing that I've found through a lot of these podcasts is the realization that a lot of people think, oh, I'd love to be in film. And you only think of actor or director or any... It's when people tend to sit down and go, oh, there's thousands of jobs in all of this.
Yeah.
That, you know, even if I'm not doing that one, I can be involved in this and I can find the one that I'm great at and passionate about. And but yeah, it's very easy to go see a billboard or a big screen and go, that's not realistic.
Right. Yeah. And, it's equated to, I want to be president of the United States. Well, here, you know, it was sort of that kind of pipe dream. So I went to school and I was studying at Rutgers. It was a journalism, mass communications, but I had watched a ton of film. I had a set my like you always had to have two majors, and I had, my second major was English, so I did, you know, I studied a lot of film. And when I got out, my original plan was to be a copywriter. I wanted to write, ads I sort of had a flair for that. But I at that point, I wasn't passionate enough about that to drive me through, you know, because being a copywriter is as competitive as being any other kind of creative, you know, and I didn't have the passion for it to get me to the next place. But the only thing I really had that kind of passion for at that point was acting. And so I moved to New York at like 19 and studied with a woman, Catherine Gately, who became a mentor of mine and was in New York for, probably about 5 or 6 years and studying and doing a lot of bad theater and doing some writing then, but not a lot. That wasn't, even though I had always... I joke now because it's the only Emmy I've ever been nominated for was songwriting, but it's really the first thing I ever wrote were lyrics, you know, and never, you know, I don't play an instrument, but I have a good sense of meter and I've always written songs so I went to New York and then I went out to LA to be an actor and I love Los Angeles and I consider it home. And
how did you find that kind of that arriving in LA and maybe where, you know, you'd kind of said you'd grown up somewhere initially that you felt a lot of people don't seem to leave or you felt very isolated.
Right.
Did LA feel like home immediately? And did you kind of feel you found your place or was it more of a...
I loved it. I was working in New York, waiting tables and... selling drugs and you know, the things we do. And then I bought a motorcycle and I took a motorcycle cross country to LA in my Kerouac phase. And it was fantastic. And I loved Los Angeles. I loved the, because in LA everything is so spread out and I have such a vivid memory of driving, through parts of Arizona and I took the southern route through Oklahoma and I stopped at one point because I came across this like plains, you know, along the highway, and it just looked like a John Huston fucking set.
Yeah.
You know? And I'd never seen a desert. I'd never seen, you know, and it was, traffic's flying by me as I'm parked on the shoulder. And this is before cell phones. I wasn't taking pictures. I was just sort of, I was sort of in awe of it. And,
just taking it in.
Yeah. You know,
it's one of my slight worries of the advancement of technology, and that there's fewer things like that are going to take you back like that, because obviously you will have seen some kind of photos of it, but not really taken in. But to be in those places, to stand there and go, oh shit, this is
at
this.
Being a kid of, you know, I grew up in front of a TV and movies, and so that was my only exposure to any of that stuff. So it
feels like you're walking into it.
Yeah,
it was like I'm standing in.
Yeah,
there.
It was really amazing, and so I still to this day, the desert is one of those places that settles me. I love it, and so I came to LA and you do what you do. I'm attending bar. I'm auditioning, my sense of timing with acting has always been bad, though. I literally landed in L.A. during the tail of the first writer's strike, and there was fucking nothing going on.
Yeah,
I found a good group of friends and was there, you know, for a while, and then it was in L.A. that I got was becoming aware of my perhaps substance abuse issues and tried to clean up on my own a little bit. And then
it's a place that tends to bring it out of people. If it's there, it's kind of, that's where it will come up in your life. We were discussing before we started, it can be a bit of a badge of honor in LA now to be, I'm dealing with this, but I think it's because of that. It's somewhere that will send you one route or the other.
Yeah.
Either you'll go down and it'll be bad, or you'll you'll have that support and that prompt to go, right, I need to deal with this.
And I think it's also because it was for me, you know, even though I was on my own in New York and stuff, I had family that was always, you know, a train ride away.
Yeah.
And they saved my ass many times and bailed me out. And out there, I really didn't have that. Not that if I was in trouble, they wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
But it was just sort of, it was really about, this is my home now, and I'm out here alone, and you know, it's a different head. And then eventually I realized that I love, you know, acting. I love the arts, and then my plan was to go back and teach and direct. And I went back to New York with my mentor, Catherine, and studied with her again as a teacher.
Wow.
And was teaching the Meisner Technique in New York for a couple of years and directing plays at the Nathorn Theater. And then, you know, I had no really designs on going back to graduate school. I had thought about it early on. But then Catherine got offered a master teaching position outside of Chicago at Northern Illinois University. And they were bringing a new arts program out there. And she kind of took me along with her. And I was able to go. And I got pretty much not a full ride, but nearly a full ride to get my MFA. So I went back to Northern Illinois, to beautiful DeKalb, Illinois, which is a fan. It was so fucking perfect for me because I don't like a lot of stimuli. And had I been like in Chicago proper, I don't know if I would have gotten the same education.
Yeah.
But in DeKalb, it's just the school and corn.
Yeah.
That's fucking it, you know?
Yeah.
And so you're really isolated, but it was fantastic. It was the first time as an actor and as an artist, I really, you know, because living was really inexpensive. I had a couple student loans, so I didn't really have to worry about surviving.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just immersed in theater and the arts 24/7. You know, it was a 3-year program. I sort of did it accelerated just because I had a lot of other professional experience I could apply to credits and was there got my MFA there but it was just such an amazing experience.
Yeah.
And that's
to have that much focus and so few distractions.
Oh, so great.
I think
it's great.
I think addiction is a word that is used a lot and it's a scary thing, but I think addiction it depends what you're addicted to. Yeah, addiction to substances or whatever, that's terrible. Mm-hmm. Addiction to art, to study, and to, I think most of the people who, or a lot of the people who have achieved great things, whether it be in business, in film, whatever, are addicted to what they do, to their work, to what they do. And, you know, that's a key to it. It doesn't have to be this, you know, dirty word.
You have to be obsessive, and I definitely have an obsessive all-or-nothing personality. It's just choosing the right all-or-nothing.
Yeah, yeah, you know? That's the tough
and
one.
And sometimes I make the right choice, and sometimes I don't. But I loved it, and it really, when I was exposed to the people that influenced me creatively in terms of... and not to sound pretentious, but like I love the poetic realists, you know, like Genet and Strindberg and like those guys, just really sort of spoke to me and influenced me a great deal. And that's really when I first started writing, was in grad school and, you know, completely unproducible plays.
Again, there's an art in reining in your writing for its beautiful, it's artistic merit and its actual realistic merit.
Yeah.
Kind of easy at points to write something that's so artistically perfect, but no one other than you is ever going to want to see that.
Yes.
And rightfully so.
Right.
You know, so it's finding that balance of stepping off a one pedal slightly. And
the great thing about, you know, and some of it is just is sobriety as well, but, you know, learning to trust. But also the greatest, you know, the fact that I'm a writer is so antithetical to who I am as a human being, because the idea of doing a draft of something was just inconceivable to me. It's like, I did this. You're either going to fucking love it. And if you don't, it's a piece of shit and I'm never going to write again. That was my approach to anything I did.
I remember when I first started getting a bit of a name on open mics, just doing spoken word and poetry and stuff. And it become a joke for me because so many people who'd been educated in this, and I'd had no education, and would be getting up going, this is a first draft of a new piece or whatever. And I'd start so many of mine like that and then laugh again. No, I'm fucking with you. I've written it down. It's finished. That's it. It's done. There's no first draft. If I'm saying it to you now, That's the first draft. That's the finished draft.
Right. And so to me, that was, you know, that was just, that in itself was huge. And,
you made a terrible choice of career then, because this is what it's all about.
It's all about, right? So, I started doing, started writing there, and then I had met the woman I was, my first wife I had married, met when I was in grad school, and then came to L.A. and
how was it returning? Like, how did it feel? Different, because it was something you'd found an instant love for.
Yeah.
Yet you'd also found some demons and some darkness there. So.
Yeah. I think it was, you know, for me, when I came back, Lori, my first wife, who's, was just a wonderful girl, and the marriage was ill-timed and didn't work. But, she was also, we were very similar, and she was an actress and writer and who had, you know, sort of channeled that into public relations and a lot of community activism and stuff, and she was from a very, you know, socially active family, and so I came, when I got out of grad school, I she was working in Denver, and I went to Colorado for about a year, and Colorado's a beautiful state, and Denver's a lovely city, but it's very it swings very to the right, a little too far to the right for
me.
And,
I
never quite felt comfortable there. And plus, not being a drinker, everything in Denver is centered around beer. So it's like everything. It's like, oh, some fest. And we both knew and she grew up in L.A. and loved Los Angeles, and her mom was there. And so we came back to L.A. So when I came back, with her and it was great. We were renting a house off of Melrose towards east and right outside of Hancock Park, and so that was lovely. And but it was really interestingly enough you know, as the marriage was sort of unraveling a little bit, and it only lasted about a year, but that's really, it was interesting because I was sober then, and there was a sense of, you know, I was really in a dark place because I felt like I destroyed her life and had so much remorse about, you know, wanting out of the marriage and blah, blah, blah. That I really, it was one of those things where I had, it was a precipice in terms of, you know, what am I going to do? And I realized that the only option I had was some sort of creative outlet, you know, and I had started writing a little bit more then, and I really just put all my energy into that. And it's one of those things where I always remember those awful corny quotes that you get when you're studying to be an actor, or a teacher or a mentor will, you know, quote, you know, Strasberg, or as a young student, you just lap it up. And then, like, you know, a few years later, you're like, that's bullshit. One of the things I remember, and I think it was Meisner that said that you can only be an actor if there's, and I'm paraphrasing terribly here, but the sense of it is you can only be an artist if there is absolutely nothing else you can do. Yeah. In other words, if there's some other escape route, if there's something else that you get esteem from or do, you know, that it's not going to work. And I reached that point where it's like, I had a stack of resumes of every other fucking job, you know, because I'm a survivor, so I'm half bright, so I can usually figure shit out. So I had so many other gigs to survive that I could do, you know, enough to get by. But it's nothing that I ever had the desire or the energy or the passion to make a career.
It gives you that breathing space, which is in a way. Or what you don't want. If you've got something to fall back on, then you're going to fall back.
Exactly.
I think I always remember it's the reason I quit my job working in a record store, because I was like, because I've got this regular income, I'm doing a bit of music on the side and all this. Right. It's like, right, I'll save up a bit and then I'll quit, and then the music has to work.
Yeah,
and that's it. That's all I've got now. I've not got the job that's just keeping me afloat. It's like, right, this has to be.
Yeah,
and, this has to be.
And it's not even. You know, there's a pressure to that, but there's also a certain amount of freedom, you know? And so I really got to that place where I was making – I have my buddy of mine who's still my kid's godparents, Christian Barcelos and Lisa were dear friends of mine in L.A. And he at that point was working for Bravo and that corporation and really, you know, kept me afloat. I was writing 1-minute bumpers for interstitials for Bravo that, you know, basically kept me alive for a year and a half while I was trying to write. And I did. It was the first time in my life that even as an actor, you know, you're waiting tables, you're tending bar, you're going on audition 1 or 2 a week and you're doing like a play and, you know, it's a very, it's a difficult way to be an artist, you know what I mean? Because your energy and your psyche is being split in so many different directions.
Essentially having to be a part-time artist because you're having to switch it off to do these other things. That are-
and especially if, you know, for me, it was always like, I always had that niggling kind of self-doubt, like, if that all goes, I can't really do that. But writing was the sort of one thing where I had written a script, Delivering Jen, which I still hope to make at some point. But it was one of those, what I consider to be kind of a divine gift in that. I wrote that after the marriage ended, and my dear friend Nicole Clemens, who was my agent for years, who's now an executive at FX, ironically, is sort of walked me through that process. And I generated this script that was good, you know, and that got me a lot of meetings. And it proved to me that I had some skill and some talent and some passion for this. And then, you know, I wrote 5 or 6 screenplays after that were garbage, but I knew that it was sort of like, had I not written that script first, to give me some sense of, oh, okay, I can
tell you this can go somewhere.
I can do this, you know? And that's why I tell my kids who are, you know, my stepkids who are musicians and actors and my son, who is a really super talented musician and really a talented songwriter. And, you know, I see that in him. He'll write a song and he'll put it right up on SoundCloud. And if it doesn't get, you know, the respect he thinks that you'll take, you know, like there's that sense of this is who I am. And then again, that's starting and, oh, it's crap. It's, you know, and, you know, all I can do is, because I know what that head's like and you can't shift that,
but trying to
deliver that sense of, or to convey to him that there is no bad draft. You know what I mean? Yeah. There is no bad song. Yeah. And, you know, I use fucking Springsteen as my model for that because, you know, Springsteen just has that huge binders and notebooks of lyrics and of songs that he never, you know, recorded or maybe even never even showed anyone. But when I write a script that's awful, there's always something in that script, either a character, a piece of dialogue.
And simply the exercise of writing and completing something is huge. Again, people forget that the brain is just another muscle and it needs to be exercised. Yep. It needs to be worked. So even if you spend a week writing and all of it is garbage, then that's fine. You've been writing. You've been engaging in that practice.
Yeah, it's the
you know what doesn't work essentially.
Right,
you know?
Right. And you're right. It's all that. It's the discipline of doing it. It's the things you learn from doing it. And I always find that there's something, you know. You know, I always cannibalize scripts that I've never, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I'll write something and I'll be like, ah, that's crap, but I love that piece of dialogue that's an interesting turn of character.
Or Interdiction, which is the song that Charlie Hunnam first sent to you, I believe, of mine.
Yes, yes.
That was exactly that. That was loads of lyrics I had left over, or, you know, the bulk of it was a load of lyrics I had left over from other stuff that hadn't quite worked.
Right.
And I kind of started to put them together and make something new, and it became one of my most successful tracks. So it's exactly that was probably, I could have just thrown away the song that had one line in it that I've now used in this, but
yeah
it all comes together.
It really does. And we should tell people that when I was in London, Charlie, who's I adore, and he was doing I was doing prep work on Bastard, and he was starting Arthur, and I'd see him all the time because he'd go. I was staying at the Charlie Street Hotel, and he was working with Guy, who has a flat in Fitzrovia, and we were talking about music, and he had mentioned you and sent me the track, and I fucking, you know, I love words, but I loved your energy and I loved your look, and I just sent you, I think I just sent you a DM or something saying, hey,
I remember it clearly. Because I'd only met Charlie like once or twice at this point, so I'd just started working on Arthur, and I noticed, I think I had a notification that you had started following me, and I sent a DM to say, you know, I love Sons, also a huge fan of The Shield, and, you know, just cheers, nice to meet you, and then we started talking from there. I guess
it's you know, for the blessing and the curse of social media, it is. I've met, like, it's how I met Ed, it's how I met Sharon. You know, it's like one of those things, and I feel like, you know, because for me it's never about schmoozing. It's always like it's an opportunity to be sincere and go, oh, dude, I fucking love
completely.
You.
Or from hearing everything you've said so far, you're similar to me in that I'm no good at. I don't go out to clubs and the right parties to meet people and to network. I can't do that. But I've learned that on social media, I can.
Yeah.
You know, if there's people I appreciate, I can engage. I can do, you know, it's that great. I think it's amazing for that, which is kind of perfect for artists, because a lot of artists are that way.
Yeah,
I can't do the bit, you know, it needs to be an agent over there doing the schmoozing or talking. Whereas, Yeah, you can meet people in that manner.
Right. That's how I, and that's, you know, that's how I met Kat, because I was looking for an artist.
Same.
And you know, she could never watch Sons. It was way too violent.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've met some really lovely people that way. And, I digress, but I just,
no, that's perfect. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's tons more I want to talk about. Okay. So I'm going to make this a two-parter.
Oh, okay.
So we're just going to continue now.
You're
in
sure?
real life.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to be bored.
But for everyone listening, I want to get into obviously The Shield and then Sons and then Bastard. So we'll stop this one now and part two will be out later.
Okay, awesome.
You've been listening to Scroobius Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. See, clearly the two of us could talk for hours and hours and hours, and we do. In fact, generally when we have a two-parter, the first part is longer and the second part's a bit shorter. It's the opposite this time, because we'd talked all this much and we hadn't really got onto all of his TV stuff, his amazing breaks and developments there. Tell some amazing stories about Southpaw, the film. You really need to hear that. But that'll be up at midday, so check that out. What's going on next? That's on at midday. So subscribe, download, tell your friends. I don't need to talk that much here. I'll see you in a bit.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.